Ecclesiastes. Last week we talked about who wrote it and when it was written and why it was written and what Solomon was trying to say in writing it. We only got three verses in because Solomon really summarizes his whole point in the second part of verse 2 and verse 3. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? We said it's kind of like Solomon is writing a term paper. He's going to tell us what he's going to tell us, then he's going to tell us, and then at the end he'll tell us what he told us. But there, the second part of verse 2 and verse 3, he gives us his thesis, his topic sentence. The paraphrase, nothing is more futile than this life, this existence. You might have seen from the slide before service or over the weekend or maybe on social media, I titled this series Dust in the Wind. And I was immediately inundated by comments from people saying, oh, I get it, Kansas. And you're from Kansas. What not many people seem to stop and realize was that, if you don't know the reference, Dust in the Wind was a 1978 top 10 song by the band Kansas. And it's a paraphrase of the book of Ecclesiastes. The lyrics in part go, I close my eyes only for a moment and the moment's gone. All my dreams pass before my eyes, a curiosity, dust in the wind. All they are is dust in the wind. Same old song, just a drop of water in an endless sea. All we do crumbles to the ground, though we refuse to see. That's everything that Solomon is saying. What's interesting is that two of the founding members of the band Kansas, after they wrote this song, got saved and went on as born-again believers to a new recording career. Chapter 1, verse 14, if you ask the band, is the verse that they drew upon, even as non-believers in writing this song. Chapter 1, verse 14, I've seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. And the reason it was a top 10 song in 1978 and still resonates today, it's a theme that echoes throughout history, throughout literature. Japanese literature, one of the great works of Japanese literature, reads in part, the mighty fall at last, and they are a dust before the wind. There's a Native American poem that says, we are all dust in the wind. What's interesting is the first pastor's conference I attended after moving to Kansas, the worship team did this song. And I was confused because it's a pretty song. You know, you got a couple six-string guitars. One is classical tuning and one is Nashville tuning. And yeah, it's a pretty song, but the lyrics are despairing. There's emptiness and then there's blackness after that. But that is a theme that echoes throughout music, throughout literature, throughout history. And it's not surprising, really, as we talked about last week, without God, that is all there is. And it's the only reasonable conclusion. We can dress it up. We can make it pretty. We can write songs about it. We can write poems about it. But at the end of the day, what are they saying? We close our eyes only for a moment, and the moment's gone, and then nothing. Well, as we continue this evening in chapter 1, that's going to be the theme that Solomon builds upon. Nothing. Pretty easy outline this evening. Starting in verse 4, Solomon is going to say, nothing ever changes. And starting in verse 9, he says, nothing new ever happens. What's important to remember is the domain of his inquiry, though. Nothing ever changes. Nothing new ever happens. Where? Where is Solomon talking about? Under the sun, in this life. Verse 4, one generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. Verse 5, the sun also rises, and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes towards the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. What did Solomon just tell us? He just told us, don't hang on. Nothing lasts forever but the earth and sky. And it seems like it should be the other way around, doesn't it? Shouldn't it be that humanity endures and nature passes away? We're living, nature, rocks, wind, water, they're dead. They're not alive. But look around, Solomon tells us. It's the earth that seems, verse 4, immovable. What do we call something that doesn't change? We say it's like a rock. Yes, we've gone from Kansas to Bob Seger. Hang with me. It's not for nothing that Jesus reached into nature and chose as a metaphor for himself a rock, steadfast and immovable. Why did he pick that idiom? Because it's the closest thing in nature to his unchanging being. Verse 5, Solomon says, the sun doesn't seem to change. Yes, it rises in the east, seems to make its way across the sky, sets in the west, and then while we're sleeping, it does a quick lap around and starts over again. Kind of like kids playing dodgeball. It rises in the east, it sets in the west, and then it circles back around, but it does the same thing every single day. The cycle repeats every 24 hours. That's where we get the expression, as sure as the sun sets in the west. Wind in verse 6, same idea. It moves, it changes direction, but it's always there, especially in Kansas. I was living here, I think, a month, 6 weeks at the most. We were living in an apartment on the west side. I woke up in the middle of the night on high alert. One of those times you wake up and you don't know what woke you up, but you know it's for a reason. And I'm going through the list of possibilities in my head. Is there somebody in the apartment? And I'm listening, no. If there were someone in the apartment, the dog would be going nuts. And I'm thinking, is there somebody outside? No, the dog downstairs would be going nuts. And I'm thinking, did Michaela cry out? Is she okay? And I actually got up and looked. No, she's sleeping. I finally realized it was dead calm. After just a month in Kansas, dead stillness was freaking me out. Because it never is not windy here. Solomon says that's another aspect of the unchanging nature of this world. The wind seems beyond control, but it's always there. And if you stare at it, it's actually sort of predictable. In Israel, the wind comes from the north in the winter, comes from the south in the summer. Come to think of it, it's not that different here. It changes, it fluctuates, but it's a constant background function in our lives. Verse 7, the water. Solomon here is doing what Job did in our last study. He's referencing something that was unknown to the science of his day, but he's describing the water cycle, isn't he? It rains, the rain runs from streams to rivers, from rivers to oceans where it evaporates, and the process begins again. And the thing is that the oceans never overflow, but they never really diminish either. Scientists tell us at any given time, oceans hold about 97% of the Earth's moisture. It's just a constant recurring pattern. It's a cycle. And that's Solomon's point. Nothing really changes. Even things that seem to be in motion, the sun and the wind and the rain, they're closed loops. They're closed systems. The sun goes back and forth. The wind goes this direction, that direction. The water goes up to the sky, falls down to the ground. But nothing really changes. It's another theme of music and literature. Harry Chapin, as long as we're in the greatest hits of the 70s. All My Life's a Circle, right? The Lion King. Grayson knows that one. The Lion King, Circle of Life. Growing up in the 70s, as I did, required reading in my elementary school, we had to read a lot of the great works of Native American literature, and especially the Sioux Nation. Black Elk was someone I remember reading as a little kid, who wrote, just as the seasons form a great circle and they're changing and always come back again to where they were, So too the life of a man is a circle from childhood to childhood. Yeah, Lion King didn't come up with that idea. Black Elk is pointing at seasons. Solomon is pointing at the four elements that the ancient world considered to comprise nature. Earth, fire, if you will, the sun, air in the wind, water. And he's saying that's the world we live in, as opposed to the life of man. But what they have in common, they're both certain. They're both predictable. Really, the only difference, when the circle is complete in nature, it just begins again. When the circle is complete in us, we end. Yeah, the circle of life begins again in another person, but we pass from the scene. Our lives slip away, and all your money won't another minute buy, says Kansas. Why is it like that? Solomon's just surveyed all four elements of nature, earth, wind, fire, water. They all point to one conclusion. Nature marches on and grinds us down and eventually defeats us. Why is it like that? We can try to replicate that process militarily, politically, grinding things out. I think about a football team I played on. We were tiny relative to the teams that we were playing. I was 185 pounds in those days, soaking wet. I was the biggest kid on the team. And so our coach ran us and ran us and ran us and ran us and ran us on the premise that if we were in better shape, if we pushed the pace, we'd grind the other team down, we'd outlast them. That's what nature does. That's where we get this strategy. The thing is, nature wins every time. And humanity loses without exception. Seems wrong, doesn't it? We're alive! Fire, water, wind, the earth, they're dead. There's no life in them. Why does no life triumph over life? Why does lifelessness triumph over something that would seem to be unique, special, powerful? Why is it, in the words of Kris Kristofferson, that we're just rivers that roll forever that never get to the sea? They're not wrong. Solomon, Kansas, Kristofferson, not completely. Even for you and I with a bigger perspective, who know that there's life beyond life under the sun, death feels horribly wrong, doesn't it? I talk about that at virtually every funeral I do, virtually every memorial service I speak at. Death feels wrong, even at the funeral of a believer. We tell each other we don't mourn as those who have no hope, but we mourn, don't we? Because we know every fiber of our being in those moments cries out, it wasn't supposed to be this way. It's not supposed to be like this. We were supposed to be immortal. And we are immortal. But we were never supposed to know death. That wasn't part of our original design. We have that broader perspective, you and I. We know that God is bigger than nature. He has to be. He created nature. We know that God can stop the sun the way that he did in the book of Joshua. We know he can part the sea the way that he did in Exodus. We know that he has power over the wind, over the rocks. We see Jesus in the Gospels calm the waves. And we know that Jesus overcame death. We know all that. We're confident in all of that, right? And death still feels wrong. So think about what it is to be you. Think about how violently wrong death feels. Imagine how much more so, or remember how much more so it felt when you were someone without that hope, without that perspective. To that person whose entire life is lived under the sun in this world, for this world, For that person, existence is, well, at worst it's agony, but at best it's monotony. And that's what Solomon says in verse 8. All things are full of labor, work, striving, sweat. Man can't express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. We want to believe. We're desperate to find something more, something better, something different, something that eases the pain, something that alleviates the boredom of this world, the tedium. A new invention, a unique experience. And as we live, as our lives march on, we're more and more frustrated, aren't we? Or maybe just more and more resigned. We give up. Because we realize what Solomon just told us, nothing ever changes in this world. What can we bring into this world? Or what can we bring into our world that will make a difference? I was thinking the other day about our 24-hour news cycle and our obsession with social media. What is that about? Is it really any different than the Athenians we read about in Acts 17 who spent their time, Luke tells us, who spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing? We're just like them. We just have better toys. We have a broader range of sources to draw upon, but we suffer from the same affliction. We're looking for something new, something different, something better. And the reality is God has placed eternity on all of our hearts. Nothing else will satisfy. Doesn't stop us from looking. And that's Solomon's point. He says, believe me, I've tried. Tried everything in this life, the things I like, I tried them twice. And I'm here to tell you, verse 9, nothing new ever happens. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It's already been in ancient times before us. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. Verses 4 through 8, Solomon said, nothing really changes. Verses 9 through 11, he just said, nothing new really happens. And we desperately want something new to happen, don't we? Something to break things up, to interrupt the cycle, to change the pattern. And it never does. Not if we think about it. Not if we look carefully. I mean, you and I, we read this, we're inclined to respond, oh, come now, Solomon. It's too bad you didn't live in our day. It's too bad that you didn't live to see the 20th century or the 21st century, the age of planes and space travel and computers and iPhones and GPS and antibiotics and atomic weapons. Solomon, our existence is nothing but change. But is it really? That's what he would ask if he were here. That's what he's asking through the words that he wrote for us. Are things really all that different? Planes and spaceships, yeah, they go further, they travel faster. But aren't they just ways to travel? We've been traveling forever, haven't we? On foot, on horseback. We're doing the same thing. We're still traveling. Different ways to do a fundamentally basic human activity that's as ancient as we are. Is there really a difference between an atomic bomb and dynamite? Only in scale. Just ways to blow things up. Are cruise missiles anything but a bigger bullet? Are bullets anything but smaller, faster rocks? Just ways to kill each other. When you get down to it, is an iPhone anything more than a way to tell stories? Another ancient human endeavor? Are antibiotics anything but a way to allow us to continue our same lives longer? I'm grateful for antibiotics. If it wasn't for penicillin, I wouldn't be alive today. I would have died of pneumonia 10 years ago. But it doesn't change the fact that 10 out of 10 people still die. And for those who don't know God, it doesn't change the fact that most of them live lives of quiet desperation in the meantime. All we're really doing, Solomon is arguing, we're coming up with new packaging. The basic story of human existence, our basic functions and activities, they haven't changed. And it's possible we're not even being as creative with the packaging as we think we are. Verse 10, it's already been in ancient times before us. I think about that verse when I see photos of Stonehenge, or the giant statues on Easter Island, or the Mayan architecture that is significant only when viewed from great altitude, or the pyramids for that matter. How advanced are we really? Are we doing anything that hasn't been done before? We know nothing of the pre-flood civilization. It's possible we're still inventing things that they had already invented. Even if you don't want to go that far, and you don't have to, fun to speculate about. But even if you don't want to go that far, Solomon would argue the most that we're doing is the same thing again and again in different ways, expecting different results. And we should really stop expecting different results. When I was in elementary school, third, fourth grade, maybe fifth grade, I had a hamster. And I don't know if they still make them or not. Do they still make habit trails? Yeah? So habit trail was this modular, connect the plastic tubes kind of a thing. And you could create a maze, a little city for your hamster or your family of hamsters as big as you wanted. Just as much money as you wanted to spend on little plastic things snapping together. And there was the little house, and there was the little house that was a circle, and there was a little house that had two levels that they could climb up in. And you could connect it to a wheel, and you could connect it to a wheel that goes like this, and a wheel that goes like this. And over time, it took up like half of my bedroom. My hamster was living a good life. Could take them all week to get from one end to the other. This is what I spent my allowance on. I would mow lawns and then go buy stuff for a rodent. But at the end of the day, nothing changed. The hamster still lived in a closed system. He had new and different ways to entertain himself, but he was still in a cage. And I could snap as many tubes and wheels and cubes onto the thing as I wanted, but it didn't change the fundamental nature of my hamster's existence. That's us, Solomon says. And he goes on to say, believe me, I wanted to prove otherwise. Verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. I've seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed, all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Solomon was king of Israel at the height of Israel's power, at the height of Israel's wealth, at the height of Israel's geographic expanse. Israel has never had more territory than it had under Solomon. At the height of its power and influence, people would come from far and wide to see Israel, to see the temple, to talk to Solomon, the Queen of Sheba, and others. And Solomon, with all of that influence, with all of those resources, with all of that reach, with all of that might, concluded, wherever you go, whether you have a lot of money or no money, it's the same old song. Just a drop of water in an endless sea, and all we do crumbles to the ground, although we refuse to see. We don't want to admit it. We don't want to acknowledge it. We're desperate to infuse this existence with some kind of meaning. You might as well give up, Solomon tells us. I've tried. With more time, money, and influence than all of you put together will ever have. Under the sun in this world is futility. And you're either seeing it, You're recognizing that it's crumbling before you, or your hands are over your eyes and you're refusing to see it. You're ignoring reality. You're obsessed with trying to find the new thing, the next thing, the better thing, the different thing that'll be the game changer. Think about this world's obsessions. Don't they all trace to that root desire? Politics. This leader's going to make a difference. That law will bring lasting change. These policies will make it better. Why? We want our lives to be more stable, our neighborhoods to be friendlier, our existence to be more predictable. But we're just snapping tubes on the habit trail. Climate change. And let's not get into whether we think it's real or not. It's an obsession for many in this world. Why? Because we want to overcome nature. We want to have power over the weather. We want to make those forces work for us rather than against us. Health. The billions and billions of dollars that are spent to cure diseases, but beyond that, to try to clone people, to try to transplant not just livers and hearts, but brains. Why? When there's nothing after this life, death is the great enemy. Prolonging life as long as possible is the highest goal. And then technology. While we're waiting for death, a certain death, no matter how long we draw out this life, we want to distract ourselves. We want to inform ourselves. Why? Because knowledge gives us the illusion of control. If I can't control things, at least I can understand things. And what's interesting is I think about these things, I think I start to see how Antichrist comes to power. And I know that's sort of a weird change in direction, and I'm only guessing, of course, but think about it. Think about the person who manages to combine, or at least promises to combine political stability and environmental stability with stability of health, longevity, and technology, making this replicable, distributable. Who's not going to throw in with that person? Or that artificial intelligence, because I think that's a possibility. If you can't overcome death like Jesus did, what does a counterfeit Jesus do? If you can't overcome death, isn't overcoming this world the next best thing? I think that's how Antichrist will win the hearts of the sons of man, verse 13. Sons of man, sons of Adam, in other words. Those born with a sin nature who haven't allowed Jesus to bring victory into their lives, who haven't allowed Jesus to overcome death in their lives, who are still preoccupying themselves with trying to overcome this world, not realizing that Jesus has already overcome the world. Wow, Patrick, it's a good thing we're different. Are we that different? You and I, believers in Jesus Christ, I hope. Well, yeah, because we know Jesus has overcome sin and death. We know Jesus has overcome the world. Are we acting like it? Are we living like it? Or are we more like the sons of man Solomon is writing about than we want to admit? Are we living under the sun? Because that is our choice. We can have our residence here, or we can decide we're making our life here, trying to change things that can't be changed, trying to find the next new thing, new car, new game, new house, new phone, new restaurant, new vacation, new diet, new self-help program, new job, new ministry, new friends, new family. Sometimes change is good, don't get me wrong. Sometimes we need change. Sometimes God calls us to change. Sometimes change is our idea. Sometimes God is saying, stand pat, play those cards. And we said, I want something different. If we tug at where that thought comes from, I need change. I need something different. A lot of times, isn't it because we're just bored? We're kind of unhappy, a little depressed, feeling out of control. That's the one that I battle. I feel out of control. So I start to think, well, maybe if I change something, maybe if I exert control over something, maybe if I demonstrate that I can dominate something, even if it's just doing the dishes, taking out the trash, maybe I'll feel better because I'll feel back in control of my life. But what is that if you go with that? If you start indulging in mood-altering change, what's that another way of doing? Isn't that just another way of trying to prove we don't need God? If I can just pull this lever, turn this switch, make this adjustment, maybe I won't need to rely on God in this moment. And I've seen people, believers, go to extremes. I remember a 20-something couple when I still lived in Minnesota, a brand new believer at the time. And I watched them because I was interested. Okay, what is it to be a believer? How do believers live? And it was interesting because one day they'd show up and they had new glasses. Oh, you got new glasses. Yeah, you know, we decided we needed new frames just to feel better about ourselves. And I was at their house one day. Wow, this is new furniture. Yeah, you know, we couldn't relax in the living room with what we had. And I realized at one point that they had turned over their wardrobes completely. Well, yeah, I mean, if you don't look good, you can't feel good. And in their kitchen was a whole shelf of supplements. Because if you just take the right pill, that whole portion control and exercise thing, that's for other people. They would take elaborate vacations to clear their heads. They bought a house that they couldn't afford because the apartment just made them feel closed in. They got pets because they weren't ready for kids, but they needed something to take care of because we're made to be nurturers, you understand. One person in the couple changed jobs because she just couldn't be herself in the other job. They were Christians. And they were Christians who ended up tens of thousands of dollars in debt because not much of that change was their idea. So God was under no obligation to provide for it. They were Christians who ended up divorcing, and in one case, divorcing again. I think because they ran out of other things to change. What did they miss? The only thing that can really change in this world is us. From the inside out, not from the outside in. How does that change happen? Jesus. That's the change that changes everything, or should. That's the change that changes our eternal destination, obviously. But it's also the change that gives us a new nature that allows us to be satisfied and not have to chase it in sin and addiction and debauchery. It's the change that gives us new priorities. I give you this new commandment, Jesus said, love one another. It's the change that gives us a new name, a name that God picks out, a name by which He calls us, because it's the change that changes who we are. We're no longer sons of man. We're sons of God. We're adopted into His family. It's the change that should change everything. In Christ, we're a new creation. Pretty comprehensive, right? Ultimately, it's the change that gives us a new body so that we can inhabit the new heaven and the new earth, a body without a sin nature. That's the real answer to all of this world's problems. And that's the remedy to our pain and our boredom and our frustration, is to not live under the sun, but to start dwelling in the heavenlies, as Paul writes to the Ephesians. To dwell in the next world, right now, right here, today. Do we need to be good stewards of this planet? Sure. God put Abraham in charge of this planet. He said, take care of it. We've inherited his ministry. I think we could actually do a much better job as believers. And should we care about our fellow man? Of course. It's a big part of what we're here to do. Love God, yes, and love others. But in taking care of this world and loving others as ourselves, should we expect to change the fundamental nature of this planet? No. Should we expect to alter the fundamental nature of humanity? No. Will we be the ones to undo the curse? Are we going to discover anything, anything that satisfies our soul? Not in this world. And we have to remember, our goal isn't a better life under the sun. And our goal isn't a better life under the sun for our children either. We're not even one chapter in. Solomon has made that emphatically clear. We're not going to find one. We should save our energy and not go looking. We should set our sights higher. We should hold out for something better. Homework this week as we wrap up. Think about two changes in your life. Think about the last big change you made and the next big change you're thinking about. The last big change you made and the next big change that you're thinking about. You can decide what big is. But ask yourself and ask God, pray. Really consider from every perspective why. Why those changes? Is it you trying to make a change? Trying to create, fabricate, alter something? Or were they because of the change Jesus made in you? Was it you trying to change something? Or was it you letting Jesus change something? Think another way of thinking about it. Were you trying to make the world, your world, better for you? Or was it about trying to make directly or indirectly, trying to make eternity better for someone else? The last big change you made, the next big change you're thinking about, is it going to matter in 50 years? Or was that change something that was sort of about the next 10 days or the next 10 minutes. Last big change you made, the next big change you're thinking about. Ask yourself, why? Why did I do this? Why am I thinking about doing this? And as you think about that, as you pray about it, remember, God saved us so we could break the cycle. God saved us so we could get out of the habit trail. God didn't save us to leave us grasping for the wind. What's in our hands? What are we holding on to? What are we reaching out for? Lord, we thank you that we are new and different, that we are changed because of Christ Jesus. Lord, we pray that that change, that transformation would lead to more change, that it would beget change in our lives, and Lord, through your grace, in the lives of those around us. But Lord, we pray for eyes to see. What is true change, eternal change? and what's just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Lord, give us sensitivity to discern the things that matter, the things that are eternal, the things that are born of love, the things that testify to grace, and the things that serve ourselves, the things that serve to distract, the things that we do to take back power, to give ourselves the illusion of control. Lord, help us know that difference. Help us appreciate that distinction. And Lord, help us choose wisely and well. Something you can do to help lift your eyes and consider where our help comes from. Here at the church, we have a leadership team that meets almost every week. And that group is responsible for considering day over day, week over week, month over month, what are we putting our energy towards? What ministries, what meetings, what events? Is it time to start something? Is it time to recognize that the season has ended for something else? And there's tremendous benefit in having that conversation with other people, in being forced to say out loud, this is why I think this initiative or program or gathering serves our greater mission to win and build and send disciples. Because if we can't draw a bright line connection between something that we're doing and that mission that God has given us, we shouldn't be doing it. And of course, the board of the church performs the same function on a strategic level. Who does that for you? Who do you talk to? Who do you bounce things off of, pressure test ideas with? Because just in being forced, not with a gun to your head, but just by virtue of sitting and having a conversation, hey, would you pray with me about this? Hey, would you give me your thoughts about that? Just the exercise of having to say it out loud is a pretty good reality check. Is this coming from me? Is this serving me? Is this trying to create the illusion of control or distraction or happiness for me? Or can I really look someone in the eye and explain how it's about God or others or both? I hope you have someone like that in your life. If you don't, we'd be happy to pray with you, and we'd be happy to pray that the Lord would show you somebody who can do that at a different time, in a different place, and on an ongoing basis in your life. We're called the community. God has invited us to be part of one another, and part of that one anotherness is offering a reality check. Why do you think that that's something that God would have you do? How has God shown you that? Has he confirmed that in his word? Has he given you verses to substantiate that? What do other godly men and women in your life think about that? Are you sure you have a peace about that? Man, just having someone to ask that those questions. They don't need to know the answers, but someone who loves you enough to sit with you and ask those questions, that's beyond price. And while you're praying, if you need to, pray for God to bring someone like that into your life. Pray also about being that someone in somebody else's life. That might be how you discover the person that God is leading you to.